Okay, today I'm speaking with Alora Jerenincourt, Assistant Professor of Economics and Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley, about her research paper, Can You Move to Opportunity? Evidence from the Great Migration. The Great Migration, dated most expansively, started in the late 1910s and continued until 1970. Over this period, 6 million African Americans from the South, mostly rural, moved to northern cities. Before you began your research, there had already been a decent amount of work looking at the economic results of migration for the migrants themselves. What was already known about the connection between geographic mobility and economic mobility, and what new questions did you then want to ask?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the Great Migration to the North, I mean, the North was known as the promised land for a reason, and research on the effects of the migration on the migrants themselves had shown that you could essentially double your earnings by moving to the North. So comparing you to sort of good control groups of people who stayed in the South, migrants could literally double their earnings throughout the Great Migration. So I was aware of that research just because of my training as an economic historian and also my love for history and Black economic history. And it was when I saw about, you know, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, these maps published in the New York Times on where is the land of opportunity in the United States based on the work of Raj Chetty and his collaborators. It was then that I noticed two things about, you know, the geographic patterns in upward mobility in the US today, which is that the South is kind of this region of low upward mobility. But then there were also these pockets of low upward mobility in cities across the northern United States. And I immediately, you know, recognized those as the former Great Migration destinations. So in other words, it's kind of the map seemed to show that where Black people in the US live, you know, those areas have low outcomes. And the fact that the former Great Migration cities looked that way, I thought was tragic because, again, this was the promised land. This was where you were supposed to be able to escape historically, you know, Jim Crow and the explicit repression of the South and kind of live your potential and aspire for your kids to live to their full potential as well.
So you approached this question of the remaking of some of these northern cities into places of low opportunity by comparing northern cities whose demographics were significantly remade by the migration, the ones that Isabel Wilkerson referred to as the receiving stations, to those that were not major destinations for new African-American arrivals from the South. What kind of patterns and variations did you see in flows of people from South to North?
Right. So I was very interested, as you just said, in kind of understanding how these places that are part of the promised land became essentially mobility traps. And it's important to know, as I started digging into this and looking at where Black migrants went in the North, I noticed that they actually went in higher numbers to places that were better in the past. You know, they had very good outcomes, they had higher upward mobility to the extent that we can measure that using historical census data. So one, it seemed like, you know, if you could imagine African-American migrants had the map of opportunity in 1940 and they followed it. So that's the first thing. The second thing to note is it is true that much of the migration was driven by the search for economic opportunity in the manufacturing sector. And so there is a correlation between where Black migration increased in the North and the share of the labor force in manufacturing, so the degree of industrialization. And then also a very strong driver of where migration occurred is the presence of communities of migrants from the South before. So Black migrants tended to go where there were communities of Black Southerners. There were also, and this was important for my research strategy, idiosyncratic links between specific locations in the South and specific cities in the North. And that's what allowed me to estimate, you know, the quote unquote causal effect of the Great Migration on Northern cities was by exploiting the fact that for example, Detroit drew migrants, the plurality of migrants into Detroit came from Alabama. The plurality of migrants into Baltimore came from Virginia. So I could use economic changes in Alabama or in Virginia to predict the change in the Black population in Detroit or Baltimore. And that was really critical to isolating out the effect of this dramatic change in the racial composition of these cities and this increased migration from other characteristics of these locations in the past that might have also, determined the trajectory of upward mobility in those locations. I can give actually some specific examples that might be helpful. For example, in Alabama, as the share of agricultural labor in cotton, for example, declined over time, as that sector shrank and experienced economic decline, you had more and more people, leaving the state and leaving for better opportunities. A lot of them ended up in Detroit. Another example is Virginia, which during World War II was actually the recipient of a lot of defense spending. Now this works in the opposite direction because it creates local jobs and increases the opportunity cost of migrating out of Virginia. So you can use those numbers to determine, lower levels of migration into Baltimore.
I was struck hearing you talk about how well chosen the destinations were, because we know how deliberate the efforts to restrict information were. And so it's kind of remarkable and really impressive that the choices were so well made. Your research focused in particular on migration in the period 1940 to 1970, and then the 21st century outcomes for the urban northern residing children and grandchildren of those migrants. What was your headline finding? The northern destination cities, as you noted, were almost certainly better places for the new arrivals to build a life than the places they left behind had been. And how did their descendants fare in those cities?
My headline finding essentially is that the Great Migration and this influx of Black Southerners into northern cities dramatically changed the destinations. Cities reacted to stark shifts in their racial composition. And when I say cities reacted, I mean a bundle of things. I mean that there was increased white flight out of urban areas into suburban ones in these destination metropolitan areas. There were changes in government spending, reallocations, especially towards police and policing. And then there were also declines in the quality of the urban environment, higher crime, longer commute times, urban sprawl, all kinds of examples of how life had gotten worse in Great Migration areas. And the key thing that I find is that the kids growing up in these locations today suffer worse outcomes. So if I were to compare children growing up in the Great Migration, a former Great Migration destination, to those growing up in a northern city, but one that was less affected by the migration, I find that those in former Great Migration cities do worse as adults. They earn lower income as adults, and on a number of outcomes, look to be doing less well.
So this is a heartbreaking finding, and you describe some of the ways that these doors of opportunity started to close. Did these destructive reactions, the white flight, the segregation, the disinvestment in social infrastructure, the over-policing, all of these things, did they tend to make northern cities worse places to live for everyone? Were the people driving these changes really shooting themselves in the foot, or were the harms concentrated?
So it's important to note that the effects weren't the same for all groups. What I find is that Black men kind of bore the brunt of changes in destination locations in response to the Great Migration. So very precisely, Black boys growing up in Pittsburgh, which was, at sort of the median of this big influx of Black migrants flowing to the north, compared to those, say, growing up in Baltimore, which was really at the high end, got a lot of migrants coming in, they do worse even when I condition on the family resources they grew up in. So take two kids parents earning the same amount, one growing up in Pittsburgh, one growing up in Baltimore. The one growing up in Baltimore is going to do worse as an adult, is going to earn less, and is going to be less likely to work. So that's a very striking finding. And I find that these effects really are largest for Black men. They're true for Black men from low-income families who grew up in low-income families, but also for those who grew up in higher-income families. So looking at those whose parents were in the higher part of the parent income distribution. When I look at other groups, the effects are more muted there. So for example, I see very little effect on white men and women, especially those from higher income families, and still muted effects for those from low income families. Interestingly, I find muted effects for Black women as well. And that kind of ties back to an existing literature that finds that boys are more responsive to changes in their environment, changes in their family structure than women are, than girls are. And you know, the reasons for that, there are many, and that's kind of a whole separate literature. My findings are very consistent with that. The effects are really kind of loading on Black men as a subgroup. And that sort of clued me into some of the mechanisms that might be explaining those differences.
So in reading your work, I'm reminded of Hirschman's exit voice and loyalty framing. If you're in a bad situation, do you leave and head for something better? That's the exit option. Or do you stay and do you try to make changes to where you, that's your voice option? And then how do the uses of these two strategies interact with each other? So what do you think we can learn from your research about strategies, both individual coping strategies and collective action strategies, for confronting the racial inequities today?
Well, I like to say that if you look at the history of Black people in the United States, it's very clear that collectively, Black Americans have acted rationally. So when conditions were really bad in the South, there was a mass movement out of the region in search of places without codified, you know, political, economic, and social repression of Black people. And as we've discussed, you know, there were clear gains at the time, and we think it was the right move at the time. I sort of formally analyze that in my paper and say, you know, where would Black people be without this huge population movement to a higher income region of the country? And they would be worse off. At the same time, you know, northern cities really sort of failed Black Americans. They came for a better life. Cities reacted to Black people moving in these ways that I've discussed, you know, white flight and increased segregation, changes in sort of like the urban policy response to urban decline, we think has ultimately harmed Black men in particular. I think there's a lot of research showing that criminal justice policy has exacerbated racial inequality. So taking all of that into account, in northern cities didn't kind of hold up their end of this moving to opportunity bargain, and Black people turned around. So since 1970, net migration for Black Americans has been towards the South, back towards the South, not to the north. And that's a really big change. And I think that it's, again, very, very rational. If you look today, and this is maybe, you know, surprising to people, but outcomes for Black Americans in the South are, if not, you know, they're even better than in a lot of these northern locations. So that's kind of the collective strategy, I think, is, you know, another search for opportunity. And I'm hoping to look at this more closely in upcoming work. The South is more racially integrated than the North. Housing outcomes look a lot better, higher rates of home ownership, higher rates of living in new housing units. So there are all these dimensions on which the South actually looks better. Individual coping strategies, boy, that's a tough one. I'm not sure the best answer to give there. I know that when I look, and I, you know, this comes back to the gender heterogeneity, there is some piece there about what Black women are doing to try to make up for the loss in income of the men who they typically form partnerships with, you know, because I don't see that their economic outcomes are as adversely affected It's hard for me to figure out how and why. I need better data to do that, but there are clearly some coping strategies to try to get around this. But I think we need probably more. And I think one of the big takeaways of my paper is that, you know, as a counterpoint to a lot of work that's pushing moving to opportunity or housing vouchers to address poverty, I think we need to think seriously about policies that lift places up rather than inducing or incentivizing people to leave. Because one, that kind of policy, the housing voucher policy, it's only going to ever affect a tiny, tiny fraction of people. And two, if you really were serious about scaling it up, you'll get into these unintended consequences. So we really need to think about how to lift up communities where they are.
Is there anything I forgot to ask about that you would like to add? Any gaps in the outline we've given?
I think I probably could have talked a bit more about the mechanisms. We just barely touched on crime and policing. And, you know, my paper is sort of limited in its ability to say, you know, this is the mechanism. But if I were to tell and sort of, you know, myself too, what's the next paper that should be written on this topic? And I really do think it is an investigation of our criminal justice system and how it's affected Black men and their economic rights and their economic outcomes. So I know that there's a big debate about, an ongoing one about, you know, efficacy of policing, the consequences of policing for communities. And I think this is precisely the area that we need to take stock of. Have our policy responses to urban decline greatly exacerbated racial inequality?
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.